From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Salt Lake City, Utah.
It's hard for me to know why you'd want to work at an institution that you said didn't even exist. You said it doesn't even exist, and you want to work there.
Some have said that sending you to New York would be like sending Nixon to China. I'm concerned it'll be more like sending a bull into a china shop.
Senators grilled John Bolton during his confirmation hearing as ambassador to the United Nations. We'll play excerpts of the hearings. Then, as Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon meets with President Bush in Texas, we'll speak with Amira Haas, the only Israeli journalist living in the occupied territories.
The issue is not about expanding settlements. They have expanded enough. The issue is about the very existence of settlements. And the idea to have peace with settlements remaining there in Palestinian territory and cutting through it and fragmenting it into Basnustans, this is inconceivable.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Salt Lake City. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush's nominee to serve as ambassador to the United Nations came under intense questioning Monday during the opening day of his Senate confirmation hearings. Members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee grilled Bolton on his highly critical comments on the UN and his treatment of intelligence officials in the State Department. This is Senator Joseph Biden.
Some have said that sending you to New York would be like sending Nixon to China. I'm concerned it'll be more like sending a bull into a china shop.
Bolton vowed he would form a close partnership with the UN. All the Democrats in the committee are expected to vote against Bolton. If any Republican joins the Democrats, Bolton's confirmation would be blocked. On Monday, Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island said he's inclined to vote for Bolton. Chafee is widely viewed as the most moderate Republican on the committee. Activists from the group Code Pink briefly interrupted the hearing by holding up banners reading, "No Bolton, Yes UN." We'll have more on the Bolton hearings in just a few minutes. This news from Capitol Hill. The Senate will open confirmation hearings today for John Negroponte, President Bush's nominee to become the country's first national intelligence director. Negroponte's tenure as U.S. ambassador to Honduras 20 years ago is back in the news. The Washington Post reports today newly declassified cables and memos from the early 80s shed new light on Negroponte's connection to the Iran-Contra scandal that saw the Reagan administration secretly arming Contra rebels in Nicaragua to overthrow the Sandinista government. In July 1983, the House voted to halt all aid to the U.S.-backed Contras. Negroponte responded by sending a cryptic message to the president's national security advisor and the CIA director, urging them to keep the secret arms deal alive. Later, the arms deal would publicly come to light as the Iran-Contra affair. Negroponte wrote in July 1983, quote, "Hondurans believe special project is as important as ever." At the time, Honduras was secretly being used as the logistical base for as many as 15,000 U.S.-backed Contras. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has indicated to reporters he intends to brush off a warning from President Bush not to expand the number of settlements in the West Bank. Israel has plans to build 3,500 new settlement homes in the West Bank and to build a corridor connecting one of the area's largest settlements to Jerusalem. The construction is illegal under international law and violates the so-called roadmap to peace. On Tuesday, President Bush held a news conference with Sharon at his ranch in Texas.
I've been very clear about Israel has an obligation under the roadmap. There's no expansion of settlements.
But after their meeting, Ariel Sharon defended the expansion and vowed to continue building a corridor between the large Male Adumim settlement and Jerusalem, which will, in effect, permanently redraw the map of Israel. Sharon said, quote, "The blocks will be part of Israel with everything that that entails." In Iraq, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld is making a surprise visit to meet with the country's new prime minister and president. Rumsfeld's visit comes just 3 days after supporters of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr staged the largest anti-U.S. protest since the invasion 2 years ago. On Monday, Iraqi militants staged a coordinated military-style attack on a marine base near the Syrian border. The Washington Post reports the militants used gunmen, suicide car bombs, and a fire truck loaded with explosives. Also on Monday, a U.S. contractor was kidnapped in Baghdad. Officials have not released the name of the contractor or his firm. Earlier today, a suicide car bombing went off in Samarra, killing three and injuring at least 20. Meanwhile, Iraqi outgoing human rights minister Bakhtiar Amin has admitted that the conditions of Iraqi-run jails are deplorable. He said, quote, "None of the Iraqi detention centers meet international standards for cleanliness, food, and the treatment of prisoners. Neither are the buildings up to standard," he said. Agence France-Presse is reporting 17,000 men and women are now being held in U.S. or Iraqi-run jails. About two-thirds of the detainees have never been formally charged. And court-martial proceedings have begun for a U.S. Army sergeant who killed two of his fellow soldiers in Kuwait by throwing a grenade into their tent. Newly released court transcripts have given new insight into how detainees at Guantanamo Bay were treated when they appeared before military judges last year. During one proceeding, a British detainee, Faraz Ali Abbasi, was ejected from a hearing after he repeatedly challenged the legality of his detention. When Abbasi said, quote, "I have the right to speak," the judge responded saying, quote, "No, you don't." The judge went on to say, quote, "I don't care about international law. I don't want to hear the words international law again. We are not concerned with international law." Later, the tribunal found Abbasi to be, quote, "deeply involved in al-Qaeda." However, 4 months later, the government released him. In domestic news, the wholesale price of brand-name prescriptions jumped just over 7% last year, marking the biggest increase in 5 years. This according to a new report commissioned by AARP. Overall, the price of brand-name prescription drugs have soared 35% since 1999. And this update on the mass arrests made at last year's Republican National Convention. According to the New York Times, charges have been dropped for over 400 people because video recordings emerged showing that the arrested had not committed a crime or that the charges against them could not be proved. In one case, it appears the New York Police Department tampered with video evidence. In court, the police presented a video of the arrest of a man named Alexander Dunlop, who claimed he was wrongly arrested. It turned out the video presented by the police was edited in two spots. Images showed Dunlop acting peacefully were removed. The court was not told the video was edited. This became known only after a member of the group Eyewitness Video found another tape capturing Dunlop's arrest. Once the second tape was presented to the court, prosecutors immediately dropped the charges. The city now claims a technician had cut the material out of the video by mistake. Of the nearly 1,700 cases involving convention arrests that have run their full course, 91% ended with charges dismissed or with the verdict of not guilty after trial. In St. Louis, students at Washington University have entered their ninth day of a sit-in calling on the university to pay all employees a living wage. Last month, a student sit-in at Georgetown University led to the school agreeing to increase worker wages. And feminist writer and activist Andrea Dworkin has died at the age of 58. She was best known for her feminist critique of pornography, which she first outlined in her book, Woman Hating. She was the author of over a dozen books on pornography and violence against women. In 1983, she helped draft a law that defined pornography as a civil rights violation against women. The law was passed in Indianapolis in 1983, but was overturned by an appeals court 2 years later. Andrea Dworkin often argued that pornography was a precursor to rape. She said in 1986, quote, "Pornography is used in rape to plan it, to execute it, to choreograph it, to engender the excitement to commit the act." Gloria Steinem said of Dworkin, quote, "In every century, there are a handful of writers who help the human race to evolve. Andrea is one of them. 4 years ago, the Guardian newspaper described her like this. They said, Dworkin is a threat, of course, to exactly the extent that radical feminists have always posed a threat, pointing out unapologetically the degree to which violence against women and children by men remains rampant. Dworkin died on Saturday at her home in Washington.
With a sampled heartbeat and a stolen soul, I sold my songs to have my fortune told. And it said, you should know that love will never die. But see how it kills you.
Please, Sister, by the Cardigans, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Salt Lake City, Utah, where we continue our Unembed the Media tour. Today we'll be at Weber State University at a genocide conference tonight in Palo Alto, tomorrow morning home in New York, tomorrow night in New York at Cooper Union with Tariq Ali and others. I'm Amy Goodman. The confirmation hearing of John Bolton, President Bush's nominee for U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, began yesterday in Salt Lake in Washington. Bolton has served in the past three Republican administrations and been one of the party's strongest conservative voices. He's now the Bush administration's arms control chief. During the day-long confirmation hearing, members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee grilled Bolton on his highly critical comments on the U.N., and his treatment of intelligence officials in the State Department. Bolton repeatedly played down his previous attacks on the UN. This is an excerpt of what he had to say in his opening statement.
If confirmed, I look forward to working closely with this committee to forge a stronger relationship between the United States and the United Nations, which depends critically on American leadership. Such leadership, in turn, must rest upon broad bipartisan support in Congress. It must be earned by putting to rest skepticism that so many feel about the UN system.
John Bolton speaking before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday. After his opening statement, Senate Democrats grilled Bolton during the day-long hearing. Perhaps the most confrontational moment of the day came from California Senator Barbara Boxer. She took Bolton to task on his previous jabs at the United Nations.
Mr. Chairman, I'm bewildered by this nomination, given the situation in the world where the president has gone around the world to try to rebuild relationships. Secretary Rice has done that. Mr. Bolton, I respect your commitment to public service, I do, and the good things you've done, among a whole list of things that maybe I didn't think were as good as some. But I have spent the last month extensively reviewing your writings, your public statements about the United Nations. And my overall assessment, Mr. Bolton, is that you have nothing but disdain for the United Nations. Now, you can dance around it, you can run away from it, you can put perfume on it. But the bottom line is the bottom line. And I, as Senator Biden said in his opening, it's hard for me to know why you'd want to work at an institution that you said didn't even exist. You said it doesn't even exist, and you want to work there. Now,
Senator Boxer went on to play a clip of John Bolton speaking more than 10 years ago at an event called the Global Structures Convocation. It was held February 3, 1994, in New York. This is an excerpt of what Boxer played during Monday's hearing.
If you think that there is any possibility in this country that a 51,000-person bureaucracy is going to be supported by most Americans, you better think again. The Secretariat building in New York has 38 stories. If you lost 10 stories today, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. The United Nations is one of the most inefficient intergovernmental organizations going. UNESCO is even worse, and others go downhill from there. The fact of the matter is that the international system that has grown up, and again, I leave out the World Bank and the IMF because I do think they're in a separate category, has been put into a position of hiring ineffective people who do ineffective things that have no real-world impact. And we pay 25% of the budget.
John Bolton speaking in 94 in New York. After Senator Boxer played those comments during the hearing, Bolton defended the controversial statements.
Well, the tape that you just showed and some of those statements come from a panel discussion, I think it was in 1994, before the World Federalists. The World Federalists believe in world government, and I do not.
I'm not interested in them. I'm interested in you.
I was talking to that audience at the time, so that's what I'm trying to explain.
Well, you don't say different things to different audiences.
I was... no, I don't. What the many of the World Federalists believe is that the UN is the nascent world government coming into being. And I don't agree with that either. So what I was trying to do to that audience of World Federalists was get their attention. And the comment about the 10 stories was a way of saying there's not a bureaucracy in the world that can't be made leaner and more efficient.
Well, that isn't what you said. You said it wouldn't be missed. So we can look at, you know, what wouldn't be missed. Talk to us about that.
I think a reduction in personnel is something that every manager and every government organization, every international organization should strive for. And that was the metaphor I was trying to come up with, as I say, to get their attention. The question about, you cut off the middle of my presentation in your showing of the tape.
I ask unanimous consent to put the entire statement in the record.
I appreciate that. The concept that I was addressing there is the problem of false concreteness, where many people say, well, the UN did this or the UN did that, the UN failed here or the UN succeeded here. And in the vast majority of cases, it's not a question of the UN qua UN succeeding or failing. It's a question of whether the member governments of the United Nations have made the correct decision. And that problem of false concreteness is something that I think is a very real problem.
Mr. Bolton, I don't mean to cut you off, but you're getting away from the point. I read everything in here. You didn't talk about there being you need to fire certain people. You say the point I want to leave with you in this very brief presentation is where I started. There is no United Nations. There is an international community that occasionally can be led by the only real power left in the world, and that's the United States, when it suits our interests and when we can get others to go along. And I think it would be a real mistake to count on the UN as if it's some disembodied entity out there that can function.
California Senator Barbara Boxer grilling John Bolton during Monday's confirmation hearing. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee is made up of 10 Republicans, 8 Democrats. All 8 Democrats are expected to oppose Bolton's nomination. Rhode Island Senator Lincoln Chafee was the panel's only Republican who was seen as a possible vote against Bolton. But after the morning session, Chafee said he was generally satisfied with Bolton's answers and that he was still inclined to vote to approve him. It was another Republican on the panel, Senator Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, that issued some sharp questions to Bolton on the war in Iraq. When we come back from this break, we'll hear what Senator Chuck Hagel had to say.
Splash. Ben Avigo and Kingston is gonna meet. And I can see with my own eyes, it's only a housing scheme that divides. But I live on Bombay. When the two sevens clash.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Salt Lake City, Utah, still on the confirmation hearings of John Bolton as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, as we turn now to Nebraska Senator Chuck Hagel, who questioned John Bolton about Iraq.
I'd like to hear your thoughts about the relevancy, the effectiveness of the IAEA. Director Baradi, what you think of him. I think most who are following your nomination are aware, certainly this panel is aware, that as we have seen the results of more of our internal intelligence reports, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the recent Silberman-Robb Commission report, the 9/11 report, what we've seen is that Hans Blix and the United Nations inspectors had it right in Iraq. We had it wrong. I would like you to work your way into that. How could they, the United Nations inspectors, be so right and our intelligence committee be so wrong? And that cuts to the bigger question of the future of the IAEA. Do you support the IAEA? Do you support Mr. Baradi's continuation as director?
Well, perhaps I could address the IAEA question first and then try to come to your larger question. I have been, since the first Bush administration, a supporter of the IAEA. I remember the first President Bush, in the hours before giving one of his speeches to the General Assembly, saying how much he wanted to strengthen the hand of the IAEA. It's been a phrase that has stayed in my mind ever since then. And I think we've seen just in the first 4 years of this administration that the level of cooperation with the IAEA on the question of North Korea, before North Korea withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, was very good. I think that we have had a number of transactions with the IAEA involving Iran, involving sharing some pretty sensitive information that's been very helpful. We have maintained our contributions to the IAEA. We've had numerous voluntary contributions to the IAEA's work. Our feeling on the Director General is that we support the longstanding policy of two terms for Director Generals. That's been the policy. There are no candidates to oppose him, so we'll have to see how that policy plays out. But we've said repeatedly that's not a policy aimed at him or anybody else. It's a policy that we think is good for the UN system as a whole. On your larger question, I don't think there's any doubt that that what we've learned about what we've learned post war in Iraq about our intelligence is a kind of lesson that we need to address and in a very serious way in a very urgent manner. I think the Silberman-Robb Commission I don't want to say I've carefully studied all of it, including the classified portions, but I have read large parts of it, and particularly the parts on Iraq, and I think that the Silberman-Robb Commission really captured quite well many of the failings that not just our intelligence community, but many of us had.
John Bolton being questioned by Republican Senator Chuck Hagel. A little later in the proceedings, three women peace activists from the group Code Pink interrupted the hearing. They held up banners reading, "No Bolton, Yes UN. Bolton equals nuclear proliferation, and diplomat, not bully, please," and urged senators to reject Bolton as the worst possible choice for the job and for world peace.
Chair calls for order.
We need to leave.
No, I'm Bolton. No, I'm Bolton.
The hearing is adjourned until order is restored.
The three women were quickly kicked out of the hearing. Much of Monday's confirmation hearing focused on allegations that Bolton tried to have intelligence analysts removed from their posts after disagreeing with him. Committee Democrats circulated a portion of a Senate Intelligence Committee report from 2 years ago, questioning whether Bolton pressured a State Department intelligence analyst who tried to tone down language in a speech he gave about Cuba's biological weapons capabilities. Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut asked Bolton about the allegations.
And that is the allegation that you tried to have two analysts removed from their jobs because you disagreed with their intelligence conclusions. That to me is in this environment we're in today, Mr. Bolton, I would say, putting aside your views about the United Nations, other things, if that is true, then I don't think you have a right to serve in a high post. I think it would be unfortunate to set the example in this day and age, and we're trying to get the best intelligence we can.
I noticed
that if you try to remove someone, whether or not you're successful or not is not the issue. Trying to rob a bank and failing to do so is a crime, in my view. Trying to remove someone as an analyst from their job because you disagree with what they're saying, I think is dreadfully wrong. And you've got an opportunity to defend yourself here, and I want to get to the bottom of it if we can. Now, you've made the statement in response to Senator Biden that you did not try to, or you did try to remove, or at least you recommended that these two individuals, one we've talked about, Mr. Westerman, the other we'll just call an intelligence officer because his name should be kept a private. Did I hear you correctly when you responded to Senator Biden?
I don't think so, Senator. Respectfully, the way you put it at the beginning was that I tried to have people removed because of their because I disagreed with their intelligence conclusions, and that's not true.
You thought because they went behind your back.
I thought in both cases, if I may say so, their conduct was unprofessional and broke my confidence and trust, which I think is important in all professional relationships, especially in ones involving intelligence.
Let me address that particular point. Now, because I understand it, Mr. Westerman, who, by the way, has a distinguished background, is highly regarded by his peers, and I'll lay that out for the record hearing here, going back and interviewing his superiors and others over the years. As I understand it, and you correct me if I'm wrong now, that this going behind your back, Mr. Westerman sent an email to your chief of staff, as I understand it now, Frederick Flights. Is that how you pronounce his name?
That's correct.
He sent an email in February to your chief of staff that tried to alert your assistant that you were probably going to have trouble getting the language cleared that you wanted to include and suggested alternative language at that time to him. Your assistant, Mr. Flights, pressed to have the language sent out for clearance. So Mr. Westerman did so at the suggestion of your chief of staff. The submission to the Intelligence Committee made clear the language that you wanted cleared. It was also contained, Mr. Westerman suggested alternative language. Now, for all due respect, how is that going behind your back?
You know, Senator, a lot of the material that's in...
But am I correct in my assessment of what occurred? That he did send an email?
I don't know what the circumstances were. I've seen a lot of it after the time. What I did was talk to Mr. Westerman's supervisor. I first called Mr. Ford. He was not in the office that day. I forget the reason why. Carl Ford, the assistant secretary, the head of the bureau. I then asked to speak to Tom Finger, who was the principal deputy assistant secretary of the bureau, the senior career official. And I said, basically, what's going on here? And
did you call Mr. Westerman?
I called him to find out, basically said he had sent something out into the clearance process without notifying us. So I put this to Mr.
Well,
Finger.
Well, you made a statement he went behind your back.
Yes.
And you checked?
I did. That's why I asked Mr. Finger. I didn't know what the facts were. I asked Mr. Finger, the senior career officer in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and he came back a couple of hours later with he didn't know what the circumstances were, which is understandable, I think. But he came back to me a couple of hours later with an email that said that Mr. Westerman's behavior was, quote, entirely inappropriate, close quote. He said, meaning referring to INR, he said, quote, we screwed up, close quote, and he said twice, it won't happen again.
John Bolton being questioned by Connecticut Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd. The hearings for John Bolton to be U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations continue today. The hearings for John Negroponte to be Director of National Intelligence begin today, and we'll bring you more on that tomorrow. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast in over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica radio stations and NPR stations, public access TV stations and PBS stations, as well as on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV Channel 375. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org and our closed caption for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. And a special shout out to the radio station KRCL Community Radio here in Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm Amy Goodman. President Bush cautioned Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon Monday against expanding the number of settlements in the West Bank. Israel has plans to build 3,500 new settlement homes in the West Bank and to build a corridor connecting one of the area's largest settlements to Jerusalem. The construction is illegal under international law, violates the so-called roadmap to peace. On Tuesday, President Bush held a news conference with Sharon at his Texas ranch.
I told the Prime Minister of my concern that Israel not undertake any activity that contravenes roadmap obligations or prejudice final status negotiations. Therefore, Israel should remove unauthorized outposts and meet its roadmap obligations regarding settlements in the West Bank.
Sharon responded to Bush's warnings about the settlements.
I wish to reiterate that Israel is a society governed by the rule of law. As such, I will fulfill my commitment to you, Mr. President, to remove unauthorized outposts. As for settlements, Israel will also meet all its obligations under the roadmap. As I said also in Aqaba, we accept the principle that no unilateral actions by any party can prejudge the outcome of bilateral negotiations between us and the Palestinians.
After the meeting, the Israeli Prime Minister Sharon defended the expansion of settlements and vowed to continue building a corridor between the large Male Adumim settlement in Jerusalem, which will in effect permanently redraw the map of Israel. Meanwhile, opponents of Israel's planned withdrawal from the Gaza Strip have chained shut 167 schools and nurseries in and around Tel Aviv. It's the latest in a series of actions by protesters who vow to sabotage the pullout from Gaza, due to begin in July. Well, we're joined right now by one of Israel's leading journalists, Samira Haas. She is a longtime correspondent for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. She is the only Israeli journalist who has spent the last decade living in Palestinian communities of the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. She's continuing now on a tour of the United States, talking about her latest book, reporting from Ramallah, an Israeli journalist in an occupied land. She joins us now in our New York studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Amira Haas.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. First, can you comment on the meeting of Ariel Sharon and President Bush at Crawford, the significance of it?
I could, of course, comment only on what was said to the cameras, not what was going on indoors, of which we have no idea. And I think it was, I guess that it was much more to do with the security matters and security cooperation between Israel and the United States than it was to do with the settlements themselves. I'm surprised because it sounds like a déjà vu or déjà heard. Every now and then we hear an American official, an American president saying something about the outposts and about their illegality and Israeli obligations. But the core of the issue is not the outpost. The core of the issue is the settlements themselves. The core of the issue is what kind of a future we want in our region. Do we want a future where third world villages will be termed a Palestinian state, but they will be third world in third world conditions, live next to a first world Israeli settlements and towns, and they are third world because these Israeli settlements and Israeli cities took all their land and all their resources from them all over the years. This is about our future. It is not about Bush concern with one comma or another comma in the roadmap. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain the process that's about to happen?
I mean,
why the pullout from Gaza and not the West Bank?
Yeah, I think it fits into a general plan of Israel's governments, both Labor and Likud, to fragmentize the Palestinian community, Palestinian people, and actually to make it live as communities, not as one people in its territory with its right for self-determination, but as groups of communities in fragmented, disconnected chunks of territory, enclaves, Bantustans, you name it as you want. And each such territory, each such enclave will be treated according to the behavior of its population inside. If Palestinians in Gaza behave well, they will get some permits to go to work outside, to work in Israel, to work in the West Bank. If Palestinians in Nablus, for example, the enclave of Nablus, will not behave well, the siege around them will be tighter. In order for the Israeli settlements to prosper without hindrance around Nablus. I think this is the general plan. And then the world might term it a state, but I don't think we are. This will be a real state deserve of the word.
As you come to this country for a brief trip, how do you compare the coverage you see here, if you've had a chance to see it, with what is covered by the Israeli press in the occupied territories?
Actually, since I watched, until I watched your news this morning, I was hardly aware of the world here in the few days that I'm here in the States, because I was in a hotel and the cable, their stations were busy mostly with all, I guess, important home news. So I know everything about fires that broke out, but I don't know anything about the world.
What about your decision to live in the occupied territories? The only Jewish Israeli reporter to do this over the last decade. Can you talk about just the process that you came to do this and where you've lived?
First, I would like to say that there are many Israeli journalists who have been working for different papers and especially for Haaretz for years and did not live in the occupied territories, but still their coverage of the Israeli occupation was very meticulous, very accurate, very courageous till today. For me, it seemed like, I guess it fits my temperament. I guess it fits my curiosity. I wanted to experience life under occupation day by day and night by night, not just on visits here and there. And it was when I never was satisfied with what I learned from Palestinians in my short visits. And that's how almost 10 years ago, when I started going to Gaza, before I became a correspondent, I stayed more and more overnight at friends' place, first in Gaza City, then in refugee camps. Then I wanted to know more. And the more you know more, the more you realize that you need to know more.
We're talking to Amira Haas. She joins us in our New York studio. I'm in Salt Lake City. She is a reporter for Haaretz newspaper. We'll continue our discussion with her in a moment. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Israeli journalist Amira Haas, longtime correspondent for Haaretz newspaper. She is the only full-time Jewish Israeli journalist living among Palestinians in the occupied territories, has lived in Gaza, has lived in the West Bank. Her books, Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Days and Nights in a Land Under Siege, and her most recent book, just out, Reporting from Ramallah, an Israeli journalist in an occupied land. She joins us in our New York studio. Can you talk about the influence of your family, of your parents, of the Holocaust, and why you've chosen to report from the occupied territories?
I grew up in a house of survivors and left-wing activists since before the Holocaust and afterwards. And this quest for justice, the anger with power, the being dissidents, it was a way of life. It was as natural as you waking up in the morning. So that's why I say it wasn't all my decisions later on, my related to work and then going to Gaza, were not such a revolutionary. They were not so revolutionary as it might sound. You could say I'm even conservative. I follow the suit of my parents.
Your parents in the concentration camps?
My mother was a survivor of Bergen-Belsen, and in Bergen-Belsen she wrote a diary, which was of course very dangerous, and she would be killed on the spot if the Germans discovered her writing the diary. She also ran a clandestine school for the little children, Yugoslav children, in her barrack, and this needed of course a lot of cooperation with the other inmates. While she was writing in her diary, other inmates were watching around and making sure that no capo, no collaborator, no German approaches or gets closer to the barrack. And teaching the children was without books, of course, without anything, just to keep them busy and maybe to let them. To let their curiosity go cross this terrible reality where they were, all of them. I don't know how many of them were left alive afterwards. My father was in a ghetto in Romania for 3-4 years in the Ukraine. And I lived in this, I grew up in this environment where one never shied about what happened to the Jews as victims. I learned to ask from my parents how the Germans could kill like that, not how the Jews could have died like that. And I think it was a very important message for me. Later on, I knew that my parents came as refugees to Israel. They were not Zionists, and they chose to come to Israel, even not really understanding why they chose to come to Israel. But later on, with the years, I realized, and I might have even given this answer myself, there was such a vacuum was created in Europe after the Holocaust, not only because of the 6 million, not only because of the murder of the 6 million and all the graves and unknown graves that were there, but the fact is that Europe did not know how to accept back the Jews who remained alive. In so many countries, in the East Europe and West Europe alike, the people who returned from concentration camps were seen almost as strangers, or as if it wasn't their place. And this was one of the reasons why my parents, as refugees, chose to go and maybe to try and live a better world in Israel. And then they were so very frustrated with the knowledge that while coming and becoming seeking for refuge in Israel, and the establishment of the State of Israel, was involved with the terrible dispossession of another people, of the Palestinians. And this life in this contradiction, I think, has determined our lives all these years long, and until their death a few years ago.
Amira Haas is our guest. What is the reaction of the Israeli population to your writing from the occupied territories and of Palestinians to what you're doing?
Well, there are many... Israeli society is very, very variated, and you would hear a plethora of reactions. Some would say I'm a traitor. Some would be very proud of me. I've heard quite often from military officials that they know that I'm very accurate in the details that I bring. I think it has been proven that these details, this information that I gather, but because I'm there on the ground and because I talk to people and collect testimonies, it has been proven how accurate it was. Things that were written not only by me but others who go and speak directly to Palestinians, not through the channels of Israeli intelligence. So things that we wrote and said at the beginning of the Intifada are common knowledge today about the Intifada being a spontaneous outburst of Palestinians, about Arafat not planning it. In a way, he was very scared by the Intifada, by the uprising. Testimonies about the behavior of the Israeli army. Now there are so many testimonies being exposed by Israeli soldiers in a group called Breaking the Silence, Shovrim Shtika. So these are also some of the reactions I get. People do know that I do remember that I wrote about it 3-4 years ago. Then as for Palestinians, I think I have often also criticized, and I am the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian leadership. I'm able to write things that maybe other Palestinian journalists think but do not dare to write or do not have the right, the place to write this criticism of the leadership. And I do hear people saying that... this is good that at least I can write and express their criticisms. I don't think that the Palestinian Authority always likes what I write, and I wouldn't expect them to like. I mean, I would have been worried if they liked everything which I wrote. As a whole, and it's true about me, and it's true about other journalists, and it's true also about Israeli activists who fight against occupation, that we turned out without planning to be the good messengers of Israel, because it's through us that Palestinians know that Israelis are not only settlers and soldiers of occupation.
We're talking to Amira Haas. Her latest book is called Reporting from Ramallah. Before that, Drinking from the Sea at Gaza. Why that title, Amira?
Drinking the Sea at Gaza? Go and drink, an expression in Arabic, go and drink from the sea means go to hell. It's like jump to the lake in English. And when I looked for a title, Arafat was saying a lot that, oh, we'll reach, in 95, 96, he was saying in public meetings, public gatherings, and we'll get to our state, and whoever doesn't like it, go and jump into the lake or go to hell. And people were laughing because sometimes he said, go and jump into the, or go and drink the water of Gaza, and sometimes he said, go and drink from the water of the Dead Sea, depending where he was talking. Now, in Hebrew slang, hell and Azazel is hell. And then in Hebrew slang, it was shortened into go to Gaza, which means go to hell. So it was sort of a pun.
Amira Haas, you've said there's been a form of apartheid for 33 years talking about Israel and the occupied territories, and the Oslo Accords did nothing to change that. You said the Israeli army is used to Pravda-like reporting. It resented your articles, but your editor told you, get up their noses, so you must be doing a good job. Can you talk about what you mean by an apartheid-like system?
An apartheid-like system is when we are talking about two peoples who live in the same territory between the sea and the river, the Mediterranean and the River of Jordan, two peoples, and there are two sets of laws which apply to each separate people. There are privileges and rights for the one people, for the Israeli people, and mostly for the Jews among the within of the Israeli people. And there are restrictions and decrees and military laws which apply to the other people, to the Palestinians. The Palestinians as a people are divided into subgroups, something which is reminiscent also of South Africa under apartheid rule. You have the Palestinians, the Israeli Palestinians, who are citizens but of Israel, but seventh grade citizens. You have the Palestinians of Gaza, and you have the Palestinians of the West Bank. And now you have Palestinians in every different enclave. There are different restrictions and different decrees which apply to these different enclaves. And you have the Jerusalemites, East Jerusalemites. So all this subdivision of the other people, which disconnects them, which fragments them as a people. And then you have one government which is elected, which actually decides about the future of both peoples, the scope of development of both peoples, but it is being elected only one by one people. For me, this is a form of apartheid, of demographic separation, which is meant to improve the conditions and the well-being and the future of one people on the account of the other.
Can you describe a day in Ramallah, your latest book, reporting from Ramallah, what it feels like to be there?
Ramallah is an easy place. I call it prison five stars prison. This is the easiest. That's where occupation is the most lenient in terms of closures, invasions, attacks, economical siege. It has to do. It has to do with the fact that there are more diplomats in Ramallah, more Palestinian Authority officials, NGOs, foreigners who work for NGOs. So it is like it's a sort of a vitrine of the show window. Which doesn't reflect what is really happening anywhere else. Also, the people with most Palestinians with money are concentrated in Ramallah. So you can get. It's not difficult life. I could not complain about life in Ramallah. It's going from Ramallah to Nablus, to Jenin, to Hebron, to Gaza, which is so difficult because the differences, the contradictions are so striking. And also going from there to Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, where I have friends and things to do, or going to Tel Aviv, this is very difficult. I live in permanent jet lag when I go to these places. It's a half an hour distance or 20 minutes distance, but it's the difference between third world and first world. Life in, and also, I mean, with everything I said, it is prison. Ramallah, good as it is prison for the Palestinians. It is not for me. So I also have this, the bitter taste. I also live with a bitter taste of being free and being privileged to move around.
How do you deal with the Israeli press?
I'm sorry, I didn't
attacks.
Hear the beginning of your question.
How do you deal with the Israeli press attacks on you? For example, the Jerusalem Post and the issue of being objective. What is your response to that whole line of criticism?
I doubt if anybody can be objective. All of us who are Israelis, we are part of this conflict. We cannot be objective. This is a myth, and it's a myth always taken by those who support the official policy. All of us have opinions. All of us have certain angles from which we view the situation. The thing is, if you report correctly, if you bring facts, if you allow different voices to be heard in your reporting or to determine the reporting. And I think I've been trying to do this as much as I can and as much as my work requires. And you know, Jerusalem Post, I don't follow it. It's not it has not determined my writing.
Amir Haas, my last question to you is, what do you think it's most important that people in this country understand about Israel and Palestine?
The two most important things is that these two peoples, Israelis and Palestinians, could very easily come to an agreement, to a fair agreement and to a fair peace solution. Fair. Israelis have to prove that they are ready to cut this link of dispossession, this chain of dispossessions that started in 48. This is what Palestinians have expected us to do, to show that we do not just add another link of dispossession to another link of dispossession, and they would have replied by their willingness to live side by side the Israeli state. Also, what is important that Israel insists now to get its benefits or to get its way thanks to its military superiority. Now, this is very dangerous for the people in Israel, for the Israelis, because this feeling of military superiority or the situation, the state of being military superior, will fire back in after 20 years, 30 years, I don't know how long. But if this is the only guarantee for our remaining, of our living there in the region, this guarantee might be changed in some years. Maybe we won't be able to give the services we are giving now to the United States. Maybe there is a change in Egypt or in Jordan. Different regimes will emerge there, which will weaken the position of Israel in the region.
Amir Haas, we are going to have to leave it there, but I hope to speak with you again before you leave the United States. Amira Haas, her latest book is reporting from Ramallah, an Israeli journalist in an occupied land. She writes for Haaretz. I want to thank all the people who made this broadcast possible, the remarkable team in New York, Mike Burke, Shrufo Dokuduz, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Skeho, Yoruba Richin, Dennis Moynihan, and Troy Williams. I want to thank the folks here in Salt Lake City. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.